You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Joel toku ingoa, no mai haere mai ki te wai mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to the Wire for Rahina Monday. I'm your host Joel and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm joined in studio by producer Samantha. Coming up on the show, there will be no catch-up with Te Pāti Māori and for the immediate future, due to the very tragic passing of our spokesperson for the party, Takutai Kemp, last week, our thoughts go out to her, her whānau, friends, loved ones, and Te Pāti Māori as a whole. For our weekly catch-up with the ACT Party Simon Court, I speak to him about the passing of Takutai Kemp and the Regulatory Standards Bill, specifically about David Seymour's posts criticising individuals opposing the bill for suffering from Regulatory Standards Derangement Syndrome. I speak to Joshua Yuvaraj, a senior law lecturer at the University of Auckland, about Meta's copyright win over 13 authors over using the author's work to train their Llama AI models, and what this means heading forward regarding AI and copyright infringements. And I speak to the medical director of the Asthma and Respiratory Foundation, Bob Hancocks, about the Healthy Home Standards coming into effect tomorrow, and the organization's concerns regarding landlords' ability to self-certify that their homes meet these guidelines. Samantha, what do you have for us today?
I spoke to Forest and Birds Regional Conservation Manager Nikki Snowyink about a bill in Parliament that would allow pests such as deer and tar into our national parks. I also spoke to Saeed Bourotane, Professor of the Department of Chemical and Materials Engineering at the University of Auckland, about a world-first study looking into electrical fires in rubbish trucks caused by improperly disposed ion lithium batteries.
He aho whakaaro, we would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch. Tuku pātuhi mai, text in on 5395, or waiamai rānei, give us a call in studio on 309-3879. Kaua e ware ware e a hei ana koto te whakarongo ki e nei, kōrero ano hei pakihiri roki roki maurunga i te pai tukutuku o irirangi poho, me haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com.
It's time for our weekly catch-up with the ACT Party's Simon Court.
Last week, Te Pāti Māori MP Takutai Kemp passed away at the age of 50. She had previously taken leave from Parliament last year due to suffering from kidney disease. Following the announcement of Kemp's passing, the House adjourned early in the week out of respect for Kemp, her whānau, loved ones and Te Pāti Māori. For our weekly catch-up with the ACT Party's Simon Court, I spoke to him about the passing of Takutai Kemp. We also discussed the Regulatory Standards Bill. Last week, ACT Party leader David Seymour created multiple posts on his Instagram accusing individuals such as academics Dr. George Laking, Dame Anne Salmond, and Materia Ture, as well as Labour's Willie Jackson, of suffering from Regulatory Standards Derangement Syndrome. In response to this, Wellington Mayor Tory Farnow wrote to the Prime Minister accusing Seymour of attempting to stifle academic opinion and any dissenting opinion. She added that Seymour's acts breach sections 2.53 and 2.56 of the Cabinet's manual. 2.53 calls for ministers to conduct themselves in a manner appropriate to the office, while 2.56 requires ministers to act to the highest level of ethical and behavioural standards. As well as this, we discussed the bill receiving over 130,000 public submissions, but only being allocated 30 hours for these submissions. But first, we discussed Takutai Kemp. What has the grieving process been like for the party?
Well, to lose somebody like Tash Kemp at age 50, it just feels like she's gone too soon. Our thoughts have been with her whānau and Te Pāti Māori colleagues, and, you know, just wishing them the best at this really trying time. It's really sad. I mean, people who get elected to Parliament because they believe that they can change things and want to do good, to see Tash Kemp and Professor Collins, have their life on Earth cut too short in this one term of Parliament, it's actually been pretty gutting. And I know that many of us will be thinking, goodness, let's make sure that we put time into our families, you know, don't neglect the important relationships as well as focus on our work and, you know, really try to focus on doing things in a way that uplifts people and respects people every day that we're given this opportunity to be in Parliament.
How will ACT be remembering her?
Well, David Seymour spoke in the House on Thursday last week and acknowledged her passing and provided some thoughts on behalf of the ACT caucus.
Recently, Deputy Prime Minister and ACT Party leader David Seymour created multiple posts showcasing people who have been critical of the Regulatory Standards Bill. This included academics such as Dr. George Laking, Dame Anne Salmond, and Matiria Ture, as well as Labour's Willie Jackson. What precedent does this set coming from the nation's Deputy Prime Minister?
Well, these are people who might not like being criticised, but they have stepped into the public arena and said things that are completely untrue about the Regulatory Standards Bill. And when academics weaponise their status to promote misinformation, they're actually undermining the democratic debate that we need to have. What they're doing is they are promoting a culture of fragility in that, you know, they can't be criticised for criticising. It's completely ridiculous. What they should do, particularly people like Anne Salmond and Tory Farnell, is actually read the bill. They'd find it's a sensible and, quite frankly, boring piece of legislation. It's a very important piece of legislation because what it says is that if a government wants to take your property or restrict your freedoms, they must answer some basic questions. What problem is this law designed to solve? How much will it cost? Who benefits? And are there any less restrictive alternatives? It beggars belief that academics and other politicians are weighing in on this, sharing misinformation, false information, and don't appear to be able to handle any criticism that maybe they should read the bill before weighing in.
Speaking more to Tory Farno, the Wellington Mayor, she has written to the Prime Minister that Seymour's posts breached Section 2.53 and 2.56 of the Cabinet Manual and were a blatant attempt to stifle academic opinion and any dissenting opinion. Does the ACT Party recognise these claims and that Seymour's posts could potentially breach these sections in the Cabinet Manual?
It's completely ridiculous. Unbelievable that Tory Farno, Mayor of Wellington, who's led that city to rack and ruin, is weighing in about legislation that that essentially holds future governments to account for good lawmaking. When it comes to David Seymour's posts, he's just pointing out rightly that a lot of the people weighing in either haven't read the bill or are spreading false information. I mean, he's responsible for getting the legislation passed as the Minister for Regulation. No one should imagine that a minister for anything is going to sit back and let uninformed, misinformed academics and politicians make comments about his work and not respond to them.
I'm just going to repeat that last part of the question there. Do you believe that Tory Farno's claim that Seymour's comments and Seymour's social media posts could breach Section 2.53 and 2.56 of the Cabinet Manual?
Absolutely not. David Seymour has every right to respond and respond pointing out how silly the people are who are spreading this false information about the Regulatory Standards Bill. If they are too fragile to accept that, hey, look, if you've got something to say, somebody else might have something to say about what you've got to say, maybe they shouldn't be weighing in on something that they don't appear to know much about in the first place.
Continuing on with the Regulatory Standards Bill here, the bill received a reported 131,000 public submissions. However, as originally reported by Te Ao Māori News, the Finance and Expenditure Committee has only decided to allocate a maximum of 30 hours for these submissions. Why only 30 hours?
Well, I've been involved in a lot of select committees, and I'm sure that in the 30 hours, they will have plenty of time to go over the detail of the bill and hear submissions from both for and against it. And also note, this is actually the second opportunity people have had to submit on this particular bill. The first time was before the bill was introduced, because it's been the subject of wider debate, and it was actually put up for consultation and public submissions invited before the legislation was finalised and approved by Cabinet for introduction to the House. So look, I'm sure the committee will make the most of those 30 hours, but you know, in terms of the ability to actually understand what submitters are communicating, you know, there's also a whole lot of written submissions which the committee is going to have to filter through, because it appears that a whole lot of them are form submissions rather than individual.
I want to touch on that point a little bit more. Is this enough time to actively and adequately engage with the public and their opinions, considering there were 131,000 public submissions regarding the Regulatory Standards Bill?
Well, I am actually worried about the select committee processes being undermined by these mass submission campaigns. It's an unfortunate trend which is placing a burden on committee staff who have to categorise the submissions and try to qualify them by, you know, are these form submissions, you know, are they actually speaking to the matters in the bill, or are they simply submissions making a political statement? I mean, we've seen lots of those with the Treaty Principles Bill, for example, didn't actually address what the content of the bill was. So that actually leaves less quality time for committee staff to analyse the submissions, which are generally trying to contribute to better lawmaking. I'm not sure this is a helpful trend.
Considering this bill has failed to pass into legislation on three different occasions, in 2006, 2011 and 2021, do you believe this time it will pass?
Absolutely. This is a coalition commitment. The legislation is now before Select Committee. It will be reported back shortly. No doubt there'll be recommendations for improvements based on what we hear from submitters. Now, we expect that most submitters will want to encourage the government to make better laws and be more thoughtful about who is impacted when laws are made and whether those laws will actually work. Look, this Regulatory Standards Bill won't stop governments from making bad laws, but what it will do is make that process transparent and force politicians who are advocating for policy that doesn't work actually to front up to the voters and explain why they still think they should do it. We expect to see some really positive feedback and constructive feedback coming through the committee process. This legislation will be passed this term of government.
That was the ACT Party's Simon Court on the passing of Te Pāti Māori's Takatai Kemp and the Regulatory Standards Bill.
That was Simon Court from the ACT Party.
Around, you know, up to 8 or 10,000.
Shit. The Wire.
Recently, Meta, the company that owns Facebook, has won a copyright case against 13 authors over the unlicensed use of their work to train Meta's Llama AI models. The case, referred to as Kajri vs. Meta, resulted in US District Court Judge Vince Chabaria ruling that Meta did not violate copyright law. As this case is a first of its kind, as AI becomes more prominent across the globe, this has raised the question of the grey area between copyright infringements and the use of AI. I spoke to Joshua Yuvraj, a senior law lecturer at the University of Auckland, about this case and what this ruling means for the future copyright claims, not only internationally, but also here in Aotearoa as well. In general, how is AI using copyright material?
So what happens is the AI company will identify material that it wants the AI model to be trained on, and that AI model will essentially analyze that content, whether it's images or words, or in this case, entire books, and break it down into statistical patterns. And basically what it's doing there is it's learning the statistical likelihood of patterns so that when it is asked for a pattern, it knows what's the likeliest response. So for example, if you asked it to generate an image of a black cat, then it would look through its data set, which presumably has been trained on billions of pictures of cats and black cats, and it would identify the likelihood of what it's producing to be a black cat statistically, and then it would give you that image. So it is essentially a large statistical predictor. And the issue with the copyright, where copyright comes in, is whether or not using it in that way to train the AI is copyright infringement or not. And that's what this case and the other case that has judgment has been handed down in were about.
As this is not a class action case specifically, the ruling will only affect the 13 authors and not any other author that has had their work used to train different AI models. What is the feasibility that heading forward that this will change for other authors and artists overall?
Difficult to say. Number one, you're right, the Meta decision, the judge was actually quite sympathetic to authors and the broader point of whether or not AI companies should have an exception under US copyright law called fair use to train the AI. And the judge made emphasize that this was not a broader judgment. Another judgment involving a company called Anthropic was a little bit more favorable towards AI companies. They basically said that copying, which is done for the purpose of training the AI, that would constitute what's called fair use, which is a broad exception in US copyright law, which we don't have in New Zealand. We have a narrow one called fair dealing. But in summary, we don't know how broad these rulings will have in their application. We have to wait and see, especially if either the authors or the AI companies take it all the way to the Supreme Court. So there's still a way to go, although these rulings would have generally pleased the AI companies.
What implications could we see from Meta's win in this case?
Well, I think we'll see any authors or author organizations bringing lawsuits being far more judicious in spelling out the harm that they will or project they will suffer. That was the main issue that caused them to lose in this case. The judge granted summary judgment against the authors or in favor of Meta, and that was simply not necessarily because Meta had made the best case, but because the authors had failed to say that the market would be unduly diluted by AI. The authors basically said that, well, there's a sort of harm that will occur, but they didn't really spell it out in enough detail or give enough evidence to support that. So the next time an author group or an organization on behalf of authors brings a lawsuit, especially in the U.S., they'll need to show that what exactly will be the harm that they suffer. And while there is a difference in the U.S. doctrine of fair use versus a much more narrower doctrine of fair dealing in the U.K., Australia, and New Zealand, which covers only uses like research or news and reporting, and in Australia, parody and satire. So you have to fit it in one of those categories. The U.S. rulings are likely to have at least some influence on the way that judges in New Zealand, Australia, and the U.K. and other common law jurisdictions consider these copyright training dispute issues to the extent that they arise. And in the U.K., there is currently a lawsuit trial ongoing between Getty Images and Stability AI. So that one is one to watch certainly for New Zealand space, because our Copyright Act is much more similar to the UK one than the US one.
You've mentioned New Zealand's copyright rules. Are we starting to see similar conversations here in Aotearoa about regulating AI regarding concerns of copyright infringement?
I think there's a broader discussion certainly about AI regulation in New Zealand. I think given that in 2019 or 2018, the Ministry of Business, Innovation and Employment started reviewing the Copyright Act, and they took submissions from the public. However, that review stalled in about 2021 or 2020. There's been sort of nothing public, but it seems that given New Zealand signed two free trade agreements with the EU and UK, which involved them extending the term of copyright protection that we give, it seems like they were waiting for that to be finalized before they restarted it. And so I have no doubt that once the review restarts, that conversation will really kick into play, especially given that the UK has just closed its copyright and AI consultation over the summer. And they were asking all sorts of questions about copyright and AI. And I made a submission to that. And the last thing I would say is New Zealand is one of the very few countries that has imitated the UK in protecting copyright for AI-generated works, or rather having a provision that may allow that. And I say may because it's a bit unclear whether it will. It was created in a pre-digital era. So all of that to say that the way the UK goes is likely to be quite significant for how New Zealand goes, but that discussion will certainly take place, I believe.
Speaking more to that point, specifically about the UK's Getty and Stability AI copyright case, what can we expect there, and how different will this case work compared to Meta's?
Well, Yeah, it will be different in the sense of it involves a broader set of issues. There are issues of things like trademark infringement and other things. But the bottom line is that American copyright law and UK copyright law and by extension the New Zealand copyright law and Australian copyright law is significantly different. So I guess we will just need to wait and see where the judges sort of go with that. Although it appears that Getty has dropped its copyright infringement allegations in the High Court. So actually, that case is ongoing on other grounds, I should say. So it's sort of difficult to bring these cases, and it appears Getty has dropped the case because the training of the data was done outside the UK. So they found it difficult to sort of make that point. So we don't know is the short answer. We don't know in New Zealand and Australia. We're sort of waiting for a sort of test case to arise. But in the meantime, the US one will be kind of influential, but we'll need to filter it through the lens of our laws and our approach to copyright law, which is considerably different than they do in the US.
Do copyright guidelines need to be updated to cater better towards future cases revolving around the usage of AI?
Yes, absolutely they do. So copyright laws need to better address the issue of, number one, AI training. So is it copyright infringement? Is it not? And if it's a case-by-case analysis, what are the factors that will help us determine that? Because otherwise what you're going to get is creators, songwriters, authors, and artists and actors really upset that their works are being used to train AI. And then the AI company saying, well, this is actually permitted or it's not infringement, and you're sort of just going to get these disputes. Now, what we are seeing actually is increased licensing by AI companies. And so what they're doing is they're going to the publishers, and the publishers are going to the creators or the artists, etc., and saying, look, in your contract with us to publish your work, we want you to sign essentially a waiver or a permission to allow train your AI using your work. And we will remunerate you at a royalty rate of, I don't know, 20, 30, 40%, whatever that might be. And I don't know the exact numbers, but it's sort of, some royalty payment. And the question there is, well, to what extent is that fair? Is that legitimate? Are creators being sort of undersold? And so I guess we'll have to wait and see what that contractual practice is, and then maybe what any disputes on that look like. Secondly, we do need to see AI-generated works protection dealt with under copyright law, because what you don't want is situations where someone uses an AI to generate an image or a song, and they, let's just say, for argument's sake, that they work on it. They put in enough of their own effort, they didn't just put a prompt in, right? And then, say, someone else sort of copies it or uses it or reproduces it, and then the argument is, well, that's AI generated, so it's not copyright protected. And even if there is an argument there or there's uncertainty there, we need clarity in the law to sort of better address that. So those will be some of the things that I imagine the New Zealand Copyright Act review will take into consideration. But, it's very uncertain grounds at this point in time.
And do you believe New Zealand is adequately prepared for future copyright cases with AI?
At present, the law is probably, it needs to be updated. So the short answer is no. And we also need to have a proper understanding, A, of the technology that is used, and B, of the legal landscape that regulates this, both in New Zealand and overseas. Being a small jurisdiction, we do look to overseas jurisdictions for sort of guidance, maybe not sort of binding guidance, but certainly guidance on how a lot of our disputes are adjudicated. And so even though we do have our robust system of law, so I do think, yeah, just an awareness of that is going to be important. But I do think also sort of a broader question that I'm investigating in my research is not so much AI-centric, but really sort of go back to the heart of why do you have copyright law? Like, why is it to protect creators? Is it to incentivize works? What's the value of human creativity? I think those questions are really important and probably questions that I'll seek to sort of bring up with the government when the review comes up. Because I think if you answer those questions at the start, you're sort of more capable of providing balanced policy in response to sort of technological developments. The alternative is that you develop policy that's very technology dependent or circumstance dependent, and then you keep having to change it. And that's really not advisable because it just creates uncertainty in the market.
That was the University of Auckland's Joshua Yuvaraj on Meta's win over a copyright claim for training their AI with unlicensed work and what this means for similar cases heading forward. We'll be right back. Text in on 53995. Any of your thoughts on these pieces?
The world-famous True School Hip Hop Show.
Thursday nights, take a deep dive into all things hip-hop with BFM's True School. Checking in on current and historical flows, beats, and grooves, both local and international. A Radio B institution spanning decades of solid cuts and the one show to know.
We like the breeze float straight out of our lids.
True School Hip Hop Show.
Keeping you clued in on what's fronting in the world of hip-hop.
True School Hip Hop Show.
Who you calling a bitch?
Thursdays from 9 to 11 p.m. with Get Ban, Luz, Max, Barry, and Ev Love in the area.
On 95 BFM.
Ah! Guys! He finally asked me out! He says he knows a spot.
It better not be ice cream at Mission Bay.
I hope it's not under the Harbour Bridge.
Oh no! What if you have to walk up Mount Eden?
He better not think Minnehaha is original.
Oh, thank God. It's a beer spot. I can try the new local brews.
The 95 BFM Drive Show. A 3-hour psychedelic playground of japes, jive and jams. 4 to 7 p.m. every weekday only on 95 BFM.
Thanks to the beer spot, your tappy place.
Oh, good day, Frank.
Yeah, it's high tide now as well, so yeah.
What is it? Was this 3 foot, is it?
Yeah, at least. So yeah.
Is it onshore? Onshore's a good one, eh?
Yeah,
cool. Yeah.
Oh. Here comes a good one.
You get it.
No, it's okay, you go for it.
No, I insist.
Okay. Damn, I missed it.
No, that was close though. You did really well.
Thank you. Actually, I might head in. My board doesn't feel properly waxed.
Yeah, I think I'll join you. It's getting a bit messy out here now anyway.
Yeah, so we just gotta get a flat white.
The 95 BFM Surf Report. All the surf, all the time. Weekdays on Breakfast and Drive. Thanks to Pro Gear Photographic.
Is the plague at all a threat in the modern day?
No.
The Wire.
As electronics continue to become a more and more accepted part of everyday life, so does the need to dispose of them when they cease to function as intended. This leads to a lot of electronics being disposed of incorrectly, along with all manner of other rubbish. While that may seem harmless on the surface, this can lead to combustion of rubbish trucks, which can be filled with all kinds of waste that can range to harmless biodegradable banana skins to highly explosive aerosol cans and very flammable lithium-ion batteries. When disposing of electrical waste, it is recommended to consult with the Auckland Council website for a full list of approved e-waste disposal locations. I spoke to Saeed Burutan, Professor of Chemical and Materials Engineering at the University of Auckland, about an experiment that was carried out in conjunction with Auckland Council about the dangers posed by electrical fires in rubbish trucks. So my first question is, how widespread is the issue of rubbish truck fires caused by lithium-ion batteries?
Good question, Sam. Seeing a lot of batteries being improperly disposed of definitely has been an issue for quite some time, and we are seeing more of it now. The reason is we are becoming more dependent on batteries and battery-powered devices like phones, laptops, tablets, e-scooters, cordless power tools. Basically, that transitioning into electrification resulted in huge amounts of end-of-life lithium-ion batteries, or used lithium-ion batteries. Unfortunately, many of us still throw these end-of-life batteries into our general waste or recycling bins, which isn't safe. That batteries can catch fire, could be damaged during transport or processing of waste or recycled materials. And fire is the main issue, which can put lives at risk and cause millions of dollars of damage to our infrastructure, waste and recycling infrastructure, and can also disrupt our waste services. We are seeing quite a lot of accidents happening recently due to that improper disposal of end-of-life lithium. And this is not a New Zealand issue, this is a worldwide problem.
These fires are particularly dangerous and difficult to extinguish. How have fire services been responding to these problems?
So was the purpose of our study. So that study, which was in collaboration between Auckland Council and our University Research Centre circuit, was designed to better understand the risk of lithium-ion battery fires. Because at the moment, there is no specific protocols for dealing with that type of fire, lithium-ion battery fire. In order to develop a new safety measures and protocols, we need to understand the risks. And that's why the Auckland Council and University of Auckland collaborated, and we designed that fire trials to understand the risks, to understand the emissions from battery fire.
What has the process been like while conducting this world first trial?
There are some studies on lithium-ion battery and emissions from lithium-ion batteries, but in a small laboratory scale, not real-world condition. So we designed a series of trials using a real rubbish truck. So we filled the rubbish truck with batteries and other general waste. We set the batteries on fire. We monitored the heat generated during battery fire. We tried different types of fire extinguishers. We wanted to understand the efficiency of different extinguishing agents for this type of battery fires. We collected samples, airborne emissions, as well as fire water runoff, the contaminated water produced when you extinguish battery fires. And I should also add that this is a quite dramatic and high-risk trial. So there were risks, and we had a robust safety protocol in place. We worked closely with the safety professionals and emergency responders.
Given how unpredictable the contents of a rubbish truck can be, how did you account for this in your experiment, and how does it affect the scope of the findings?
Yeah, so we try to have a recipe of waste materials, which represents general municipal solid waste collected from curbside. So usually in curbside waste collection, we have a standard recipe. The types of the waste materials includes organic waste, packaging materials, plastics, paper, etc. So we use the data available through Auckland Council in order to have that general waste, municipal solid waste collected by waste management companies and Auckland Council.
These fires can cause the spread of toxic gases and contaminants. How can this affect an individual?
Very good question. Our study, one of the key goals of our study to understand those emissions, airborne emissions. We collected data on the toxic gases during the battery fire, when battery burns. Some of those emissions can pose a serious health risk to the public. Toxic gases detected through that trials were included hydrogen fluoride, carbon monoxide, sulfur dioxide, acetaldehyde, and many other highly toxic gases. So those gases pose serious health risks to the public, urban population, as well as emergency responders. Another risk here is the fire water runoff after extinguishing the battery fire. That runoff water can carry highly toxic chemicals like heavy metals and many other toxic and hazardous chemicals, which could end up in our stormwater systems or natural waterways if they are not managed properly.
What are you hoping comes out of this research?
We hope that this research can lead into new standards, development of new standards, protocols, policies for lithium-ion battery collection, transportation, for waste and recycling industry, as well as councils. Public education is another aspect, so we want to raise awareness about the risk of this type of end-of-life materials. But the most important thing, we want to send a message to everyone that please don't throw your used batteries in your rubbish or recycling. That's where the real danger lies. So instead of throwing in rubbish bins, we should take our batteries and to recycling drop-off points, to the dedicated battery recycling drop-off points. There are hundreds of free and paid collection points for batteries. Most councils and many retailers, they offer safe and free collection stations. We also have community centers, libraries, hardware stores. You can check Auckland Council or local council's websites or waste bins websites, find the nearest location for battery drop-off. Another thing is, if you store batteries in your home, you should also need to be careful, because these batteries can, for some reasons, like, you know, if they are subjected to the moisture or water, they can short circuit internally, and thermal runaway and battery fires can happen in your garage. So we suggest that keep your batteries in a cool, safe, dry place. You can also tape the terminals of your batteries with a little bit of masking tape or electrical tape to prevent that short circuit. So the key thing is, we want to deliver that proper disposal for batteries, which will help prevent fires, which can help to protect our recycling workers and keep those harmful materials out of our environment.
Okay, that was my final question. Is there anything you would like to add?
No, thank you very much. I would like to mention that this project was a very good collaboration. It's a good example of collaboration between council and university to deliver impact, to develop a better understanding for waste minimization as well as for environmental protection and safety. So we need to have more collaborations like this between councils, industry, and our university.
That was Professor Saeed Baroutain of the Chemical and Materials Engineering Department of the University of Auckland on experiments into the dangers posed by electrical fires in rubbish trucks caused by lithium-ion batteries that have been improperly disposed of.
Is it too late in the process, though, to change that?
Nothing's too late, bro. Everything's made up in politics.
The Wire.
From tomorrow onwards, the Healthy Home Standards will come into effect. The guidelines require landlords to meet minimum standards of heating, insulation, ventilation, among other things, a law that was signed into effect in 2019. Despite this, many are concerned that landlords can self-confirm they meet these standards without external scrutiny. I spoke to the medical director of the Asthma and Respiratory Foundation, Bob Hancocks, about these guidelines and how the organisation are feeling about these standards heading into tomorrow. Concerns have been raised that despite Healthy Home Standards coming into effect from tomorrow, enforcing property owners to comply with these standards is not strict enough. What enforcements are we seeing that property owners must meet for the Healthy Home Standards?
Well, I think this is mostly good news. So this has been 6 years in coming that houses should be adequately heated, they should be adequately ventilated and adequately insulated and not be damp. And so that's good. Lots of houses will be better than they had been if we didn't have these standards. And from tomorrow, this is now becomes compulsory for all rental properties that they should be complying with this standard. The difficulty is knowing just how many landlords are actually complying with it, because you can self-certify and there's no way of knowing whether they're actually adhering to the standards or not, and that's our main concern.
So for those who break these Healthy Home Standards, are there any penalties that they will face, or is it kind of like this grey area at the moment?
I'm not sure what the penalties are, but you can certainly take the landlord to a tenancy tribunal if you're a tenant and you don't believe that the standards are being met. And that's good. The difficulty is that often tenants are desperate for houses and they are in a relatively powerless situation and probably reluctant to take the landlord to a tenancy tribunal for the fear that they'll lose their rental and be asked to leave. So although there are mechanisms there for tenants to complain about landlords or complain about the Healthy Home Standards, first of all, tenants may not be able to, may not know that the house that they're renting isn't up to standard. And then even if they suspect that's true, they may be very reluctant to complain.
How knowledgeable are landlords that these changes will come into effect tomorrow? Have they been preparing over the past 6 years to meet these standards?
They should have been. I mean, the standards, were passed into law in 2019. So they've had 6 years to get prepared for this. So all new tenancies over the last few years have been required to be up to Healthy Home Standards. The law that comes in tomorrow will mean that it applies to existing tenancies. So houses that have been tenanted for many years now also have to meet the standards. So landlords have had plenty of notice. I don't know how many landlords are actually unaware of the standards, but they should be aware by now. And the standard residential tenancy agreements now have the Healthy Home Standards as part of that, so they should be aware.
Despite you being very supportive of the Healthy Home Standards, is there more that can be done to better protect those who have a respiratory condition under the current guidelines?
Obviously, the standards are obviously provide a minimal benchmark, and that's good. You know, clearly, better insulation and better heating would be even better for people with respiratory illnesses. We do know that people who live in cold, damp houses tend to get worse respiratory illnesses, particularly through winter. And, you know, obviously if you live in a house that's warm and dry, it's first of all much more pleasant, but also much better for your health, particularly for those with respiratory conditions. So it would be nice to encourage landlords to go one further than the minimum requirements in the Healthy Homes Act.
And overall, what would the Asthma and Respiratory Foundation like to see come out of these, the implementation of these standards from tomorrow?
Well, first of all, we're really pleased that they are being implemented a narrow legal requirement. But I think what we would like is there to be some formal inspection required, so independent certification. So many landlords are very good, will be quite honest and done the right thing in terms of certifying compliance of the Healthy Home Standards. But there may well be unscrupulous landlords out there who self-certify when they know that or maybe they're not aware that the house really doesn't comply. And so requiring independent certification would be a good thing.
So is this currently not in the guidelines? So if someone self-certifies that their house meets these standards, is there no checkups that they are continuing to meet these standards?
No, the current standards require landlords to certify, but there's no absolute requirement to get a third party in to independently inspect.
That was the Asthma and Respiratory Foundation's Bob Hancocks about the Healthy Home Standards that are set to come into effect tomorrow. We'll be right back.
A million new leaves.
Sundown Clown by Jim Nothing, and before that you had New Leaf by Softbait. Welcome back to The Wire on 95BFM.
The Wire.
I don't know, and frankly the whole thing gives me the heebie-jeebies.
The Wire.
Recently, new legislation, the Game Animal Herds of Special Interest Amendment Bill, has passed its first reading in Parliament, which would allow deer and tar into New Zealand's national parks after being reclassified as special herds. Aotearoa does not have any indigenous mammals, and its ecosystems are not developed for their sudden introduction into national parks. This has led to pests such as possums and rats doing untold damage to our natural ecosystems and biodiversity. This bill has been criticized as dangerous to our environment and native animals. I spoke to regional conservation manager at Forest and Bird, Nikki Snowyink, about the potential dangers of such legislation.
Currently, what is being done to prevent invasive species and pets from endangering our national parks and forests?
Well, our national parks are our treasure, and they are the last fully protected refuges for our native species. So there's some pest control going on, but not enough to actually protect the species that we need to be protected.
Why is it that animals like deer and tar are so dangerous to our national parks?
Yeah, so our national parks contain some of our most treasured species, including our great southern beech forests and podocarp forests, which are found nowhere else on the world. And these forests are also home to special species like kea and kereru, southern brown kiwi, kaka and rifleman, and even on the west coast, penguins in the forest, can you believe it? And there are also mosses and lichens and ferns, and above the tree line there's things like snow tussocks and alpine daisies and orchids and buttercups and a plethora of specialist native insect pollinators. And so what these native species do to those forest ecosystems is they eat them. They're very hungry and they eat all these native species, and they also trample the forest floors and the soils in the forest, destroying the habitat for native species.
Why are we seeing a bill like this?
That's a really good question, because it seems to fly in the face of the actual protection for our native national parks, where these are the last refuges for the native species, and that these animals are actually recognised as an invasive pest species and a known threat to these places. So I'm at odds to explain why we'd see a bill like this that flies in the face of the protection and the responsibilities that we have to protect these places.
What does this special designation mean in practical terms?
Well, for these native species, it means that the invasive species that they're trying to protect will be enshrined in our national parks permanently. So, yeah, that absolutely flies in the face of the conservation approach that we need for our national parks.
With the popularity of big game hunting in New Zealand, how much damage could be done by hunters in the process of hunting animals such as deer and tar?
Yeah, well, I think the thing is that the ecological evidence is unequivocal that the presence of these grazing pests in our forests is slowly degrading our forests and reducing the diversity in the forest. So having them in there permanently and removing the sort of objective to reduce the numbers as far as possible to enable the forest to recover will be gone.
Recently, the government defunded the Zero Predators 2030 initiative, started by former Prime Minister John Key. What does this say about how the government is viewing Aotearoa's natural landscapes?
Well, Predator-Free 2050, that was set up, you're quite right, by the national government back in 2016, and that targets small predators like rats and stoats and possums. Yeah, I guess, you know, it's another, what would you call it, another cut to conservation in New Zealand. The jury is out, like Predator-Free 2050 Limited is gone, but DOC is insisting that there is internal capability to maintain Predator-Free 2050, and they're not cutting the actual program, but the jury's out on that.
Ideally, what would Forest and Bird want to see happen with this legislation at the next reading? Have it changed or voted down entirely?
Have it chucked out completely. It flies in the absolute face of conservation, and it's just the tip of the iceberg, really. When, you know, we're talking about the last refuges of fully protected refuges for our native species, and it's an absolute move in the wrong direction for our conservation and climate goals for New Zealand.
Is there anything the public can do to get involved?
The public can make submissions and say that they want their national parks to be protected, and submissions on the bill close on the 24th of July, and I would urge everybody to make a submission in opposition to this bill.
That was Forest and Bird Regional Conservation Manager Nikki Snowyink on legislation in Parliament to let deer and tar into New Zealand's national parks.
That was The Wire.
Ko ira te ho takaka tō mō tēnei wiki. Nei te mihi kia koutou katoa I korero mai ki maua mo tēnei rā. That's a wrap on the Monday Wire. Thank you to everyone who spoke with us today. The ACT Party Simon Court, the University of Auckland's Joshua Yuvaraj and Saeed Borotian, the Aspen Respiratory Foundation's Bob Hancocks, and Forest and Birds' Nikki Snowyink. Nei rā hoki te mihi kia koutou e whakaronga ana. Thank you for tuning in. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up is the 1 to 4 with Penny.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.